Welcome to the Resolving Violence Podcast, created to deliver current Canadian prairie-based research on violence and abuse to service providers, people with lived experience, and the general public. I'm Jordan. And if you'd like to learn more about factors that influence violence and the ways you can address them, let's get started.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Resolving Violence Podcast. This week I'll be speaking with Rachel Lowen Walker, an assistant professor and program chair of Women's and Gender Studies in the Department of Political Studies at the University of Saskatchewan. She's the project director of the Social Innovation Lab on Gender and Sexuality and is a seasoned community leader and scholar who has gained a local and national reputation for her work in support of the 2S LGBTQ+ community. She's been involved with policy development, human rights advocacy, and has experience in nonprofit governments and leadership from serving as the executive director of Out Saskatoon from 2013 to 2020. Her research focuses on queer theory and gender studies, social justice and social movements, temporality, human rights, and community-led research. Today we'll be discussing a paper of hers called Call It Misogyny, which talks about the importance and power of being able to name misogyny for what it is. I hope you enjoy the episode. Okay, so welcome to the podcast, Rachel. Thank you for joining me today. We're here to talk about a recently published paper of yours called Call It Misogyny. So that's available online and it can be found in the January 2024 issue of the journal Feminist Theory. So to start us off, could you tell us a little bit about what this paper is about?
Absolutely. So this article builds on Kate Mann's book called The Logic of Misogyny, actually. And in her book, she really rewrites the definition of misogyny. And I happened to read that book. I feel like I read that book just at the right time. And it really spoke to experiences that I was having of not really being able to name some of the experiences I was having as a queer woman within the queer community. And so I had started doing some research around misogyny within queer, trans, two-spirit communities, and there really wasn't very much out there. And so in discovering the logic of misogyny, I was able to provide a language beyond misogyny as the hatred of women. And so that's the historical definition, of course, and it's a long-standing definition, but it doesn't really tell us enough about what is happening within this realm of misogyny. And so the article is about that, and then taking Kate Mann's concept of misogyny as the enforcement branch of patriarchy, and then I used that to explore misogyny as less about this singular private, insular concept of woman, and much more about expressions of femininity, and then applying that to, or taking a much more intersectional exploration of misogyny.
Could you talk a little bit about what the process of writing a paper was like? I think for some people that feels intimidating. Like, it sounds like such a big undertaking. What did it feel like?
Oh gosh, it is a big undertaking to write a paper. And I have to be honest, this paper took the longest of any paper that I've ever written. It started as a chapter in my dissertation, actually. And then I rewrote it completely as a public talk when I was the SALIS chair with the College of Law. And that was where it really started to take shape. And so we all give talks about things, or I think that was really helpful for me to talk it through with people and have this wonderful audience that was really interested in the topic and gave me a lot of feedback. And then I was able to go and start writing a lot more, but it still took a year and a half of writing after that initial talk to get to a paper that I submitted to a journal. But the process of writing a paper, honestly, it's different for everybody. And for me, it was that I just sat with these topics for so long, and I wanted to find a way to understand what was going on. And so that's where it came from. And not all papers come from those places, but this one, I really wanted to find out what was going on with misogyny, and I wanted to understand this word better, and I wanted to find something that I could start talking about to better explain the enforcement of gender binaries that was taking place even within queer communities, where we think that we are able to be much more flexible and fluid and accepting, and yet still we have these strict expectations around femininity and masculinity, and they transgress gender identity at times.
If your goal was to develop a better understanding of what misogyny is and how it actually affects day-to-day life and how it actually manifests in the world, do you feel like writing this paper brought you closer to an understanding, or is it still a work in progress?
I think an understanding of how misogyny operates in the world is still a work in progress. I think that likely the fact that it is so pervasive and continues to have such a big impact on our society is indication of how complicated misogyny really is. But I definitely, I mean, in working on this paper, I feel like I worked something out in my brain, mm-hmm. in the sense that, which was really helpful. In the sense that I started to better understand the systems at play and the systems that are, you know, policing women in the media, casual jokes about trans people, the way that misogyny shifts depending on race. I actually did start to understand those better by working through and by working through the concepts and working through not just the concepts, but the examples. That was what was really helpful. And so I really, in the paper, I really tried to use a lot of examples so that, yes, this is using a theoretical engagement with misogyny, but it's very, very real, very, very visceral. These are experiences and examples that a lot of people themselves have experienced. And so I wanted that expression to come through in the paper.
So one of the key points your paper makes, and something that you've referred to a couple times now, is that misogyny isn't just about like a single pronged general hatred of women, but more about policing expressions of femininity. So can you talk a little bit about what this distinction is and why you make this distinction?
Yeah, if we limit... So this is something that also I give credit to Kate Mann and her book, The Logic of Misogyny. But if we limit our understanding of misogyny to that historical, the hatred of women definition, then it stays in a very personal, internal, one man against women landscape. And that's just not true. And that framing makes it really difficult to see the systemic impacts of misogyny and the way that it links up with other systems. And it makes it difficult to see how it's not just sexism. It's not just microaggressions. There are really deep lines drawn around the surveillance of femininity and things that we do and experience every single day, such as the likability bias. We expect, we like women to be nice, and we like feminine presenting people to be nice and respectful and kind and sweet, and we reward them for that, and we criticize them if they are assertive, right? And have all kinds of boundaries that end up being drawn around even slight shifts. And so to say that's gender bias or that's sexism in the workplace is not quite enough, because that is misogyny operating to enforce what femininity must be. And there's societal boundaries that get set up when we continue to make femininity and what it means to be a woman and how to live as a woman, when we make these strict lines around that. And I think that things like gender biases in the workplace, or I don't know if you've heard of the glass cliff.
Yes, absolutely. For anybody listening who maybe hasn't heard of the glass cliff, could you go and do an explainer?
Absolutely. We all know the glass ceiling, but the glass cliff is another phenomenon that is increasingly being studied that tells us that women, and particularly women of color, are put into high positions in organizations, CEO, executive director, these kinds of positions, at the times when organizations are experiencing crisis or facing a downturn or really in maybe more of a precarious landscape. And so they put women into these positions without supports built around them, and when the stakes are much higher, And when they aren't able to perform or save the day, then they're scapegoated for those mistakes. And it ends up continuing this expectation that women can't be in those kinds of positions. And so these kinds of things, you know, they happen because of sexism, but people endlessly get away with these kinds of systems because of misogyny.
Thank you for that. It is definitely a term that I'm familiar with, the way that women are set up almost intentionally, not necessarily consciously, but definitely with forethought to fail so that they take the brunt of that failure. I imagine there are probably people listening that have maybe witnessed that, but haven't necessarily had the language to pin to it. So I like having those moments where you say like, hey, can you get into that in these episodes so that people, if they do hear it for the first time, they can come away thinking, yes, I know what that is now.
Yeah.
Probably one of the major benefits of research is like being able to give people those lenses and those frameworks to make sense of things that are happening. That kind of ties into what you were saying about how writing the paper helped you make sense of systems you're already seeing.
Yeah, I completely agree. Every time we have language or a bit of understanding around something that's happening, I think it takes some of the power away. And it enables us to break it down and to critique it a little bit more. So I agree completely.
Language matters. That's one of the things that your paper talks about. Speaking of that, that sort of brings me to what my next question was. And it wasn't as intentionally a segue as it may sound. I just sort of fell into that. But your paper talks about the importance of affect when it comes to the language we use, how there is an emotional or sensory element to the way people feel about words. And it argues that misogyny has more of an affective impact than words like sexism or gender-based violence. So do you have any thoughts on how we can find the language to express more specific forms of misogyny without softening that affective impact? Because again, word choice seems to matter. It affects how people feel about what's being described.
Yeah, that's why the term misogyny itself, right? So it's on the rise. People are using it more and more, which I think is important. But we also live in a society that co-opts terms, incorporates cultures, kind of when things come out that are new or new language comes out, it can lose its meaning, and intentionally so. And so I'm kind of expecting that maybe if misogyny is used a lot, it will lose the heavy hitting weight that it has. But for now, it is a word that clearly describes a lot of the things that are going on that should be used. But I think also, and I talk about it in the paper, we use a lot of acronyms.
We do.
And I get why we use acronyms. We use them because there's all these big words and it's easier to use acronyms. And we have insider language in organizations. But the term GBV, right, which means gender-based violence, GBV just does not explain what it is that's happening. Intimate partner violence, we speak as IPV. Domestic violence, DV, and these terms, the acronyms just don't do the work that the words do. And so I do think we should use the words, and I do think that we, you know, need to use words like rape and sexual assault and sexual violence, and we need to be specific about things that are happening. And I love Kate Mann's phrase, the enforcement branch of patriarchy, because that phrase itself is visceral. That phrase does a lot of work in explaining what it is that's happening. And it also reminds us to say the word patriarchy. This is an old word, and it gets kind of cast aside as, oh, that's that feminist word, we don't use that. But we absolutely need to talk about patriarchy and patriarchal systems because they maintain heteronormative gender rules and regulations. And it polices, you know, it polices expressions of femininity at the same time that it polices what masculinity should look like. Does that answer your question?
No, I feel like it did. Thank you. What you're saying about the acronyms, Earlier, I was talking about when you have the language to capture a system you've already been seeing, there's kind of a power to that. And what you're saying with the acronyms feels like that just kind of happened for me a bit. When you use the acronyms and you're not actually using the language, it's almost like you're putting a shield between yourself and what is actually being described. You're not actually looking directly at it. Whereas if you speak the full name instead of the acronym, then, or if you speak the full word instead of talking around it, then it's correct. It's confronting it more directly. So I think I can see what you're talking about there. Mm-hmm. There is a necessity to use acronyms in some cases. Like, I understand why they come up, but I can see what you're saying about how important it is to be able to name it directly. Next question, a little bit more broad. Did you come to any particular conclusions while writing this paper that you feel would be especially important for a reader to take away with them?
You know, I did. I came away with the realization that misogyny is alive and well, mm-hmm. which I'm sure is not a surprise. And because I spent very thoughtful time working through trans misogyny, it showed me clearly that misogyny is at play in the current attack that we're seeing on trans people, much more in the United States, but this is happening in Canada. And so it revealed the way that the enforcement attacks on trans misogyny and gender diversity are wrapped up in the enforcement of what femininity is expected to be and what kinds of roles feminine people are supposed to play. But not only that, it ties into the enforcement of binary gender. And so I think it shows there are no women's rights if trans communities are targeted, because patriarchy and trans misogyny are one and the same, and they work to reinforce one another.
Are there any ideas or branches of thought that you had to cut or let go of that you'd like to revisit at some point?
The paper was originally called The Time of Misogyny. Mm-hmm. And because I'm obsessed with temporality and the philosophy of time, I was really interested in the timeline of the word misogyny. That's what actually brought me to this topic, is I was interested in the fact that it was a term that was used more historically and went out of favor and then was starting to be reused. And so I talk about it being a dusty term. And so I was interested in how reuse of a term or reinvigoration of a concept, right, and the phenomenon to which it applies can almost be like a tipping point into new understandings of how we can grapple with the phenomenon. That was my original interest in the topic, was how, hey, if we start talking about misogyny a lot more, maybe we can start thinking about misogyny differently and we can respond to it differently. Because the rise of discussions of misogyny also coincided with the International Women's March and some significant global movements in support of women's rights. And I think with the state of the world, I don't know that that has fully tipped yet. Maybe we still are on the brink of that. But my fascination with the cycles of social change and the language that we use within that process definitely was something that it was something I had to cut because the publishers didn't want it in there. My first review came back and said, "You have two different papers going on here." They wanted me to cut that part. So it's still, I have a document with all of these cut paragraphs that's still sitting in my half-baked folder. But
do you have plans to revive them at some point?
I hope to. It's still rolling around. It's definitely rolling around. And especially, again, I mean, especially in light of the attack on gender identity and gender expression that's happening, these timelines and understanding when and why things ebb and flow, I think is really important, because it gives us information about, gives us more information as to how to fight it.
So we always try to close these by linking the conversation back to something practical. So given your background and expertise, if you were to give a service provider who's concerned with addressing violence a practice to either start implementing today or to work towards in the long term, can be something simple or it can be something big if you have like pie in the sky dreams. What would it be?
That's such a good question. And that's a hard question. I think that understanding that violence and abuse, assault, it isn't about us, but both about the perpetrator of that violence. And I know that's something that is already very well used and well known within practical environments. But I think discussions about the ways that extending that to also discuss the ways that femininity and feminine expression as something that isn't necessarily only attached to cisgender women mm-hmm. is really helpful in us expanding our understanding of gender-based violence and to recognize the larger systems that are contributing to that. I think that that's really important. It contributes to those moments of feeling less isolated in experiences of gender-based violence, understanding that, and also recognizing all microaggressions that we experience, gender-based microaggressions that we experience, starting to put language to the fact that they're connected to larger policings and enforcements of femininity. I think that helps us see what's maintaining those systems. Now, what that looks like practically, I mean, talking through things, understanding things, I think it makes a big difference. And I do, to anyone that I can talk to, I say, enforcement branch of patriarchy. Oh, what does that mean? Well, it means that if women show emotion in public, they are deemed to be, you know, they're not taken seriously, or they're not believed to be able to do that particular job. Oh, well, that's just a small incident of, or that's an experience of sexism. No, that's part of a larger system that ensures that women aren't able to continuously represent at higher levels of leadership, right? That's one example. Or that women don't feel safe in jobs that they're in or in spaces that they're in. So recognizing that it is a system and knowing what that system looks like potentially makes us feel less alone and also more connected in the work that we need to do to challenge it. I don't know. Is that a practical answer? Not really.
No, I feel like it could be. I feel like it is, because what you're saying is, if we're like trying to really super simplify it, you're saying people should think about these things. They should talk about these things. They should try to understand these things. So I think that if we encourage people to have those conversations and to ask those questions, then that will help shape their understanding of it more. And I think that is a pretty critical part of any work that you're doing. You want to understand what it is that you're actually trying to tackle and address before you draw your sword and go running into battle. So I would say that probably works.
I think that also by calling things misogyny and not sexism or even bullying, maybe we'll take it more seriously, because mm-hmm. we definitely need to be taking it more seriously, you know, and maybe we won't brush off those small experiences, what we call small experiences of being called names or being told to act differently. And maybe we'll see that those are indications of a deeper problem.
You know, now that I think about it, I asked that final question because we always ask that question, but the practical advice you give service providers is right there in the title of the paper, like call it misogyny, use that word, use that language. So now that you said that, it's like, oh, well, there you go. That's our advice.
Call it misogyny. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today, Rachel. It was great to have you.
You're so welcome. My pleasure.
So I would encourage all our listeners, please look out this paper. Please check out Rachel's work. It is a great read. I enjoyed it a lot. So I would encourage you to follow up on that. And again, thank you so much for chatting with us today, Rachel. I hope you take care.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Resolving Violence. If you're interested in learning more about today's guests and their research or Resolve Saskatchewan, please check the show notes below. And if what you listened to today was helpful, please consider sharing it with colleagues and on social media so we can work collectively to resolve violence. Thanks again. Until next time.